Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring. There is only one more day to sign up for the Daily Stoic Leadership Challenge. I'm so excited. We've got a huge group of people who are lined up and ready to take this challenge with us. We're going to be talking to GMs of one of the great sports dynasties in American history. We're going to be talking to some military leaders, business leaders, entrepreneurs, people who have made it their business to study these questions of leadership. Each day you get an email from me. It's 63 emails, more than 30,000 words of all new content that helps you take the right steps along that week's path. There's going to be three leadership Q&As with me. Again, a live office hours video session with me. Ancient Wisdom for the Modern Leader. It's going to be a masterclass in leadership with the cadence and rigor of a boot camp. It's also a live course, which means all the participants will join the course together. We're going to move through it together. The same goal. I'm so excited about the material we've put together for you. There is seriously just one more day at midnight Central Time. The challenge closes. You can't sign up after that. And then we're all going to be in this awesome cohort for the next 9 weeks. I hope to see you there. Sign up now. Talk soon. Hey, this is Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. As you know, I've taken COVID pretty seriously, got two young kids, can't be vaccinated, also because I can work from home, and I felt like my sort of obligation, again, per the Stoic idea of the common good, was to do everything I could to not contribute to being a part of the problem. So I haven't been in front of an audience, I haven't given a talk, I haven't gotten to go out and do what I normally do and, going on 18 months. But I did speak in front of an audience on Monday, not a huge audience, it was about maybe 30 people. And it was about something I mentioned here on the podcast before. There is a Confederate statue about two blocks from my office here in Bastrop, Texas, and my bookstore, which is downstairs. And in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder last year, finally some momentum gathered around removing this statue, which not only should not be there, should never have been put up in the first place. Even though the Civil War happened in the 1860s, the statue goes up in something like 1910. Its political implications were pretty clear. And so I donated the first $10,000 to remove it, and I've been using my platform to talk about it. We raised collectively about $50,000. We pressured the city council to agree to move it, and all was going well until suddenly the Texas Historical Commission stepped in and has attempted to slow or stop the whole thing. So I went down. There was an open hearing, and I went down and I talked about it. And I'm going to run my short 3-minute comment here for you to listen to. My name is Ryan Holiday. I'm an author. I have a small bookstore in Bastrop, about two blocks from the Confederate Monument in front of the county courthouse. I also have two young children, and I was excited to tell them that this was an example of the system working. The community rallied around an injustice in response to an injustice. We talked to our local representatives, felt like we were making progress. This was going to be removed. And then, sir, here we are a year later, and there hasn't been any progress. And when I think about the obstacles that have come up between us and the removal of this statue, I sort of stop and think, what are we talking about here? You know, we're talking about a monument that honors the worst thing that Americans have ever done to each other. And this specifically was a statue that went up in 1910. I got to know Richard Overton here in Austin before he died. He was a black man. He was actually born in Bastrop County. He was born before this statue went up, to give you a sense of its actual historical recency. There were people alive until 2 years ago that predate this statue.
And, you know, this is a monument to the Confederacy, the people who attempted to tear this nation apart for the sole purpose of extending and perpetuating slavery. And this monument sits in a county that a lot of people don't know actually voted against secession, voted against secession. And, you know, this wasn't a statue put up by grieving widows or orphans. This was a statue put up three generations later. A newspaper article at the time that went up said that this was a monument celebrating the great white-souled South, right? It was a giant middle finger to the citizens who were attempting to assert their equal rights under the Constitution, under the pledge that we just read together. It was not an attempt to celebrate history, but to hijack history. It's based on a lie. So I beg the Historical Commission to do the right thing, to help move along moving this statue, show the people that the system works, that when we come together and we talk, we actually can solve things. We want people to be peaceful. We want them to follow the law. We want them to work together. We did that. But let's not put unnecessary obstacles between them and doing the right thing. Monroe famously said that you can judge a society by the statues that it puts up. I think you can also judge a society by the statues that it leaves up, that it pays public money to maintain. And this is one of those. So please do the right thing, honor America, and please right this wrong by moving the statue. Thank you.
If you want to reach out to the Texas Historical Commission, I would appreciate you doing this. And not only is there one in Bastrop that they're trying to remove, there is also one I got reached out to afterwards by some folks in Lockhart, Texas, which is the barbecue capital of the world. They need to raise about $15,000 more to remove this one. They have to do it by September. You can check out the GoFundMe campaign. Just search GoFundMe, remove the Confederate monument in Lockhart, Texas. There'll be a link in the show notes as well. But if you want to donate, that would be much appreciated. I think, obviously, all these things should go for the reasons that I'm talking about. If you want to contact the Texas Historical Commission, you can go to thc.texas.gov/contact. Or you can just email thc@thc.texas.gov. Tell them that you think this monument should go. I would appreciate that. And I think it does make a difference. I think people want to be able to sort of do this in a vacuum. They want to be able to, you know, pretend like the implications, the consequences of it aren't real, that it's just another sort of item of business. But that's not the case. As my episode today with a wonderful poet and author, Clint Smith, details, his book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America, was an instant number one New York Times bestseller. It is basically a travel memoir slash historical narrative through some of the most controversial and provocative and, I'd say, indefensible monuments or landmarks in American history. It starts out in New Orleans. It ends all the way at a slave market in Africa. He stops in at a Confederate cemetery. Some of the most fascinating writing that he does is about the Angola prison, a former plantation turned maximum security prison in Louisiana. When I read a piece that Clint wrote for The Atlantic, I immediately reached out, got the book. I was so excited to talk to him. He is a great writer. This is a great book. You absolutely should read it. And I really enjoyed my conversation with him. And I'm excited to bring it to you. Check out his book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery in America. And you can follow Clint on Instagram as well. He is at Clint Smith III. So that's Clint Smith III. Great writer, great dude. I think you're going to like this conversation. And I encourage all of you to wrestle with history, whether you live in America, whether you live in wherever you live, whatever political affiliation you have. History is supposed to make you uncomfortable. It's supposed to challenge you. It's good that it does. That's how we grow. You can check out the book, Amazon, anywhere books are sold. I'm going to start carrying it in the painted porch. So I am going to include that link in the show notes as well. And then we also talk about Jack Weatherford's book, Indian Givers, which I also enjoyed. I put in the reading list email this month, and we're carrying in the store, and people really love as well. So check out How the Word is Passed. Check out Indian Givers. And we also talk about Wright Thompson's incredible piece in The Atlantic about Emmett Till. All definitely worth your time. Thanks to Clint. Enjoy this episode. One of the things the pandemic has revealed to me, or helped me understand history, and I think it connects to the idea in the book, but curious what you think. It was illustrative to me, you know, we're looking at, you know, basically, let's say it's like 20-25% of the population is vaccine hesitant. The vast majority of people have taken the pandemic very seriously, you know, sacrificed an immense amount, you know, put others' well-being and health above their own. And then, you know, there's clearly a percentage of the population for whom that is not just extraordinarily difficult, but sort of anathema to like whoever they are as people. Mm-hmm. It made me think, looking back historically, that, you know, we often look back at, say, the 1950s, or we look back at the 1850s, or 2,000 years ago, we get this sense that, like, everybody was on the same page. And it sort of made me realize, like, oh, actually, a small percentage of the population can hold the rest of the country or the nation or humanity hostage and do incredible damage and sort of define everything to everyone going forward. But at the time, we're actually not much more than a faction. I mean, the South is a great example of this. Like, not only did not the majority of the country want to tear the Union apart to preserve slavery, but not even only a slim majority even of the South wanted to do it. Do you know what I mean? That mm-hmm. the way that a faction can just grab hold of the machinery of government or culture and take it to an incredibly dark, screwed up place.
Yeah, it doesn't take many. And I think it's interesting because it goes both ways in some ways, yes. Right? Where, you know, it is not the case necessarily that the vast, vast, vast majority of Southerners were saying, we want to secede from the Union. We don't want to be part of the United States. We want to fight a war against these states in the North. That is not the case. But at the same time, what is also the case on the other end is that, you know, not everybody in the North was an abolitionist, right?
Right.
Like very few, the actual percentage of people who thought of themselves as abolitionists was pretty small, right? And I think that, you know, even the notions of like what constitutes as abolition in our sort of collective public consciousness today is like a very limited and sort of myopic conception of what an abolitionist was, in the sense that like I was taught that abolitionists were these people who, you know, were the opposite of the slaveholders, that mm-hmm. they were the people who you know, worked on the Underground Railroad and fought for the emancipation of millions of enslaved people and wanted wanted all enslaved people not only to be free but to have the same rights as they did if they were white abolitionists. And you later learn that history is a lot more complicated than that, and that it is not that every abolitionist believed that enslaved people, formerly enslaved people, should have equal rights. It is actually that there's a wide school of abolitionist thought in which some people thought slavery was wrong, but we should send them after they're freed to Haiti or Liberia or South America. Or you had people who believed that, you know, slavery was wrong and black people should have equal rights, right? You have somebody like Thaddeus Stevens who believed in the sort of egalitarian, in the equality of the races. And then you had somebody like Abraham Lincoln, honestly, for so much of his life, who mm-hmm. believed that slavery was wrong, but that black people weren't necessarily equipped or in a position to continue to live in the United States after slavery ended. All of that is to say, I think, you know, sometimes we like looking at history in sort of these overgeneralized binaries with these clean demarcations that actually are not as clean as people would like them to be.
Yeah, it's been interesting watching like Texas and Florida and California during the pandemic. So they're both sort of finger pointing each other, like this is the Republican response, this is the Democrat response, and using the success or failures of the respective states as somehow like sort of proof that they're right or wrong. It's like people are like, California is a liberal state and look how many sort of COVID cases and deaths they have. And it's like, yeah, like 60% of California is liberal, which is a lot,
right?
But 40% of California is also a lot. Just as, you know, Texas is a red state and Florida is a red state, but there's also millions and millions and millions of people in those states that took the pandemic very seriously, even if their local governments did not. Right. So it's like, I think when you look at the Civil War or you look at an issue like slavery, it didn't neatly sort of travel along the Mason-Dixon line. There were sort of people all over the spectrum of different beliefs. And then there was, as Lincoln says, I think in his first inaugural address, you know, there was this percentage of the population that would rather destroy the Union than maintain it. And I think that's something we're wrestling with today. Like, you know, generally, let's say the majority of us are on one page, that's great. But if a small minority is, you know, hell-bent on getting its way or no way, and they care a lot more than you do, you are kind of at the mercy of that faction.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, throughout history, always been something to say about people who are the loudest.
Yes.
And that doesn't mean that they are necessarily the majority. And kind of alluding to what we were speaking to before, is like, in some ways it goes both ways, right? Like there are people who, you know, are loud and wrong, and disproportionately because of how loud and predominant they seem, disproportionately impact the way public policy is made. But then, you know, when it's done well, there are also people who are loud and make thoughtful and progressive political change when they are not necessarily not reflective of the majority, but that the people engaging in the sort of on the ground advocacy, so to speak, are not necessarily reflective, or not, let's not say reflective, but it is not that the majority of people are doing it, which is, so let me give a concrete example. So the civil rights movement, I think we tend to look back at the civil rights movement and we assume, because of the way that it's taught, that like everybody was in the street, right? That like all, you know, it just all, millions and millions of Black people, millions and millions and millions of white people. But in terms of like the breakdown of how many people were directly engaged in a lot of the civil rights movement work and work for the Black freedom struggle, it wasn't millions and millions of people. Because the reality is that many people are just living their lives because they have to go to, they have jobs and they have to pay the bills and they have to feed their kids. And so sometimes when we look back at history, we can have a distorted sense that the thing that gets the most historical attention was something that an enormous amount of people were directly engaged in at the time. But that's not necessarily always the case, you know, because throughout history, people, most people have just been people trying to live their life outside of the sort of context of the greatest political struggles of the day.
Yeah, I think it's because when we look back at history, we want to identify with the people who did the right thing, who put themselves out there, who acted with courage, even though statistically, it's quite unlikely. Like I was writing about this recently, like the French Resistance, you know, how many people in France do you think participated in the French Resistance, you know, against the Nazi occupation? You know, 20%, 30%? It was like 4%,
right?
You know, and that's like, that's such a, that's like an invading nation coming into your house And 95% of the people were like, this is the new normal, you know? Mm. Because, and that's not to say that everyone was a coward, but we always have our reasons, right? Mm-hmm. We always have our reasons why we can't get involved. And in a way that makes the civil rights, it's almost strange that we tell ourselves that lie, because it undermines how truly impressive something like the civil rights movement actually was, that
Absolutely.
The people who did it risked everything. And they probably told themselves, hey, I'm going to put myself out there and pretty soon, you know, there'll be millions of people behind me. But they really actually did stand alone for a very long time. And then a lot of like the leader of it was killed for that. It's only, mm-hmm. you know, I was thinking about your book in Monuments. Someone just reminded me that like, we're about to celebrate, I think the 10th, it's either the 10th or the 20th year anniversary of the Martin Luther King Monument in Washington. Mm. That didn't like go up like right after he died. Like Not that went up like recently, like they just finished it. And it that's how long, you know, one might be in standing alone.
Yeah, no, and it's interesting because, you know, on the other end, the story of the monuments of so many of the Confederate monuments that we are having these conversations about now, in many ways, those didn't go up, I think, for a different reason until, you know, some of them, these were not monuments that went up right after the end of the Civil War.
No.
Monuments that went up in the early 20th century, in the mid 20th century, around the Civil Rights Movement. And then some of them, I think about the bust of Nathan Bedford Forrest that was just removed from the capital of Tennessee. And that was put up in 1978. And
wow.
Nathan Bedford Forrest is, he was a leader, a general in the Confederate Army.
I mean, he's a psychopath. Like
the first Grand Wizard
yeah,
of the right. KKK. I mean, like this is the absurdity of it, right? That we put a bust of the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan in the capital of any state.
40 years ago,
almost 1980, you know? And, but part of what it reflects is that the people who were putting that up know that that person personified the sort of, the personified white supremacy and what it stood for. In its most abhorrent form. And I think these monuments and these busts and this iconography are put up with the specific intention to send a message about what is valued and what is not, who is valued and who is not, what history is going to shape our public policy and what history is going to be pushed aside.
No, and that's why I liked your book so much. I was actually on Monday, I spoke in front of the Texas Historical Commission. I'm part of this little group that's trying to get this Confederate monument moved off the lawn of the courthouse down the street from my office here in Bastrop, Texas. And as I was explaining in front of the commission, to go to what we were just talking about, this county actually voted against secession, but somehow in 1910, somebody decided, you know, we needed a Confederate monument. And one of the things that struck me sort of looking into, like, sort of I'm down on the floor and I'm looking up, that there's sort of three rows of these commissioners, and they're two are rural, like almost all old white guys. No offense, I guess eventually I'll be an old white guy, but it wasn't the most representative panel. But what struck me as I was sort of and I'm going to run the comments at the beginning of this episode, so people have already heard them. But what I was trying to say is, like, this is a monument to the worst thing that Americans have ever done to each other, right? Not just slavery, which was horrendous, but then we decided we couldn't agree that it was horrendous. So let's murder each other for 5 years to settle, you know, who gets to decide that question.
Mm-hmm.
What struck me the most, what I was trying to express is like, why the fuck do you guys care about this so much? Like, why, like, you didn't put it up. Your grandparents didn't even put it up. Like, why do you care about this so much? Like, what possesses a person in 1978 to put up a monument to, like, not just like a bad guy, but one of the worst Americans who ever lived. I can't answer that question. I feel like your book was a journey to try to explain that. But do you have any insight as to why people care so much? Like, couldn't they just not care? And like, couldn't they just, it's already like, I guess what I'm saying is like, it's, what are you getting out of inserting yourself into, like, why are you throwing yourself in front of this monument? Like, I remember at one of the protests about the monument, I get that there's people who don't care, right? They're like, I got better things to do. It's been there for a while. But there was a group of guys that had gotten up at like 6 a.m. and set up lawn chairs to protect the monument, like a human shield.
Yeah.
And it just struck me like, why do you care so much? What would possess a person to do that?
Yeah, no, this is, you know, this is like one of the questions that not only the book is wrestling with, but I think that we've been wrestling with as a country for a long time, and certainly over the course of the past year or so. You know, so one of the places I go in the book, as you know, is the Blanford Cemetery. And mm-hmm. Blanford Cemetery is one of the largest Confederate cemeteries in the country. And I went there for the Sons of Confederate Veterans Memorial Day celebration. And it was, you know, I was a very conspicuous presence at this event as a Black man. But I went because I genuinely wanted to understand how someone comes to believe so many things that are very clearly empirically false, historically inaccurate, and mythologized, right? Like, how do you come to believe that slavery was not a central cause of the Civil War when all you have to do is look at the declarations of Confederate secession in 1861, where the states are largely saying it for themselves, where a state like Mississippi says, our position is thoroughly aligned with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest in the world.
Yeah, right? They like say the quiet part out loud.
Yeah, they were not vague about why they're seceding from the Union and why this war would be fought. You know, Alexander Stevens, the vice president of the Confederacy, said in his cornerstone speech, this infamous speech he said at the beginning of the conflict, where he was like, slavery is the reason for this great war that we are fighting. Like, he, you know, it's so direct that the idea that someone would say that is somehow irrelevant to a conflict that ended up taking the lives of 700,000 soldiers on both sides is absurd, and yet something that many people believe. And part of what I came to realize was that, you know, for many people, history is not about empirical evidence or primary source documents or historical fact. It is a story they have been told, and it is a story that they tell. It is an heirloom that is passed down across generations through family, through lineage, through community. And you know, I think about a guy I met named Jeff, who was one of the sons of Confederate veterans, and he would tell me about how he and his grandfather would sit in the gazebo at the center of the cemetery when he was a child. And they would sit there at dusk, and they would, you know, watch the deers slalom through the tombstones and chew on grass around all of these, you know, Confederate flags that waved in the air, and how his grandfather would sing him songs. They would sing Dixie. He would tell him stories about all the brave men who were buried in the cemetery, who fought in the War of Northern Aggression, who fought against the Yankees who were attempting to indoctrinate Southerners with their way of life and impose, you know, notion, customs and culture on them that was a threat to who they were culturally, but also a threat to an existential threat to their sense of self. And now that is a story that Jeff tells his granddaughters, and he brings them to this same cemetery, and they sit in the same gazebo, and he tells this story, even though this story is not true.
It's a lie.
And so the thing is, if Jeff were to accept what we just talked about, right? If you were to present Jeff with the declarations of Confederate secession or Alexander Stevens' cornerstone speech or the Crittenden Amendments before the war that was intended, you know, a set of amendments that were largely attempted to assuage Southern slaveholders and say, okay, if you don't secede, we'll put some amendments in that make it so that your enslaved property can never be taken away from you. It failed, thankfully, because the Republicans of the day were like, this is absurd. But it is another example of how slavery was the central cause and the catalyst to the Civil War. But the thing is, if Jeff is to accept that, then he would have to accept that his grandfather is a liar. And if he is to accept that his grandfather is a liar, it threatens to disintegrate so much of the foundation upon which he believed their relationship stood on. And if that sense of his relationship to this person who he loves, who helped raise him, who was so central to his life, if that disintegrates, and if he realizes that so much of it was based on lies, then it becomes an existential crisis for Jeff, because so much of who he believes himself to be in the world is tied to a person who told him stories that helped animate and shape how he moved and understood himself in relationship to the world and in relationship to American history. He would struggle to have a sense of who he is, which isn't to say that that is an excuse at all.
Right.
'Cause there are plenty of people who have ancestors who, you know, fought in the Confederate Army. I went to Blandford with a friend in the book who was doing his own sort of reckoning, a white friend who's realized that his ancestors had been slaveholders and that his ancestors had fought in the Confederate Army. And he was going to Blandford to do a sort of reckoning of his own. And he is not a son of Confederate veterans. He is not a Confederate sympathizer. He is not a neo-Confederate. He's somebody who's like, man, you know, this is a part of my family history. And my family fought in a war over something that is deeply shameful. And I think it is possible to do that, but it is hard for many people to do because it threatens to call into question so much of who they believe themselves to be.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now. Yeah, I think at the root of this, the tricky thing is identity, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a great expression, the idea of keeping your identity small. The more you identify with, basically, the stupider you are, because it constrains you, it limits you. And like, I definitely get the idea, like, hey, my grandfather told me this story. I don't want to think that he's a liar. The problem is identifying, right? Like, and this is something I said in my comments of the thing. I was like, look, my great-grandfather on my mother's side, and I only kind of found this out somewhat recently for reasons I think people understand. We try not to talk about things that are unpleasant. But I always knew my grandmother and immigrated here from Germany in the 1950s. And it only occurred to me as I got older, like, oh, you know, what did your parents do, right? My great-grandfather fought on the wrong side in the Second World War. My dad's father fought on the right side, but my great-grandfather fought for the Germans. He was drafted like a lot of Southern soldiers. But, you know, that was a very long time ago. It was a horrible thing. But it doesn't say anything about me as a person, right? I didn't benefit from this in any way. In fact, it so destroyed my family's country that they had to come here in the first place. But I think the trouble is when you find yourself identifying with these figures in the past instead of trying to learn from them or grow from them, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't say anything about me that my great-grandfather did a bad thing. It would say something about me if 70 years after he did a bad thing, I tried to put up a statue in his honor to celebrate and whitewash his accomplishments. And that's what's so interesting about right. the Civil War stuff is it wasn't the grieving widows and orphans that did it. It was like two generations later for a very nefarious purpose and an almost inexcusable, even less excusable purpose, which was to actively re-disenfranchise a whole group of people. It was basically what we're talking about, people seizing government and using it against another group of people. It was basically to say, we don't give a shit what's in the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments. That don't go around here. That's what these monuments are really about.
Yeah, I mean, and what we see is, to your point, is that these monuments are going up in every moment where there is potential opportunity for Black mobility, right? Like we see it at the beginning of the 20th century at the beginning of the Great Migration, when Black people are moving from the South to urban cities like Chicago, Detroit, New York, and even out West like Los Angeles, and are after World War II, you have many of the white soldiers who came back from, or excuse me, after World War I, you have many of the white soldiers who came back and realized that many of their jobs had been taken by Black people who had come from the South up to the North and were working in many of these factories, working in many of these places. And they hated it. They hated that the demographic makeup of these cities was changing so quickly. They hated that these men were taking their jobs. And then Black veterans similarly came back after World War I, over almost 350,000 of them, and were like, we just fought a war for this country. And we're not going to come back and be subjected to second-class citizenship when we just risked our lives to defend the promise of this nation. And so, you had this cataclysmic thing happening. And what happened is that more Black people were like, we're not going to just be subjected to this incessant racism anymore. And then more white people were like, you're not going to intrude upon our physically our property and our neighborhoods, but also socially, like our sense of where we are in the American hierarchy. And it just had this, enormous sort of cataclysmic effect. There was a huge sort of conflagration. We see the riots of 1919, the uprisings of 1919 throughout the country. And then around this same time, you see all these monuments go up because a lot of white people throughout the country are very intentionally trying to send a signal to Black Americans about what is valued in this country, and what this country stands for and who it is for. And what better way, I guess, in their mind to do that than to put up monuments to people who fought a war that was predicated on maintaining and expanding the worst manifestation of white supremacy, or the most extreme manifestation of white supremacy, which was slavery.
It's interesting too, I visited a bunch of different Civil War battlefields. At the time, we had a pretty good, first off, if you look at the official records from the Civil War, it's called it's not called the Civil War. It's called the War of Rebellion. And when you look at, there's no Confederate veterans buried at Gettysburg. I remember being at Vicksburg and looking at the cemetery and then realizing, oh, the Confederate cemetery is over there. Because when they set this up, the people who had just won this battle at this horrible cost, they weren't like, marry me, bury me next to my brothers from down south. They saw these people as the perpetrators of not just the injustice of slavery as they came to understand the war, but also the injustice of treason and
they were traitors,
right? And so it's so interesting to me that we had this sense then, but as we've gotten away from it, it's like the side with the most guilt has obviously worked the hardest to mythologize and change and distort what happened. And I think we're already seeing this, right, with the events of January 6th. Mm-hmm. Most people who watched it on TV see it as exactly as it is. And then there's a small percentage, not super small, but a minority of people who have a vested political and emotional motivation for presenting it as something other than what it obviously was. As a historian, as a culture, how does a society battle that? Like how, it's like, it goes back to your point. It's like most people just want to go back to their normal lives. Mm-hmm. And then you've got these people motivated by cognitive dissonance and malevolence and stupidity that want to spend a lot of time litigating an event and how it gets represented culturally. How does a society fight that? Like, how do you prevent lost cause mythology from being rooted in the consciousness? It strikes me that after the Civil War, there was a part of the North that just finally said, like, we don't want to talk about this anymore. You can tell yourself whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And that clearly, in retrospect, was an enormous mistake, a costly mistake.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think you're absolutely right to draw parallels between so much of what we see after the end of the Civil War and what we saw on January 6th or now continue to see about January 6th. And you know, I brought up Alexander Stevens and his cornerstone speech before in 1861. What's fascinating is that after the war, Alexander Stevens is, you know, writing his memoirs, he's being interviewed, and people are like, man, Alexander, you wrote this cornerstone speech in which you said the cornerstone right. of the new nation was the inferiority of Black people, and that it was built on the premise that slavery should be perpetuated indefinitely, and this was the cause of the Civil War. Like, what do you have to say for yourself? And he's like, I never said that. And they're like, well, wow. What are you talking about? You said it. We were there. It's in the newspaper. We have a record of it. He's like, no. They must have misquoted me. Like, I never said anything like that. They must be twisting and misrepresenting my words. And this was what was happening with so many people who fought for the Confederacy at the end of the Civil War. There was this sort of 19th century gaslighting that was happening where they were telling us that what we saw and heard over the course of 4 years and really over the course of 250 years was not actually what we saw or what we heard. And you see this with Jefferson Davis, you see this with Alexander Stevens, you see this with the entirety of the Lost Cause ideological project, which is to, you know, that they are trying to make it so that people think that slavery was a benevolent institution. As the historian Ulrich B. Phillips talks about, who was one of the leading historians of the early 20th century, talked about slavery as this thing that rescued Black people from the savagery of Africa, gave them Christianity, gave them civilization, gave them structure in their lives, talked about them in paternalistic ways as if they were these sort of a childlike who needed the protection and supervision of white people, or as John Calhoun, you know, in the 19th century, the infamous senator from South Carolina said, slavery is a positive good for both Black and white people alike. And most people don't realize that that is the predominant view that most people until the mid 20th century in this country had of what slavery was, because the Lost Cause propaganda effort was so successful. And even to this day, you know, a 2018 Southern Poverty Law Center study showed that only 8% of U.S. high school seniors were able to identify slavery as the central cause of the Civil War. Like 8%. And you know, I would hope that over the course of, you know, given what's happened over the past few years, that number would be higher. But we live in a country in which there has been an intentional systemic effort over the course of decades to prevent people from thinking holistically and honestly about what has created the conditions of the society that we live in today. And when you don't understand the history, when you're not taught this history, and to your point about like, how can we combat this sort of strange gaslighting and lost cause propaganda, part of what you have to do is proactively teach the sort of history that will not allow us to fall into the trap of thinking that the reason one community looks one way and another community looks another way is somehow because of the people in those communities, rather than what has been done to those communities generation after generation after generation. Because once you acutely understand the contours of American history, you can look around and understand that the reason that this country looks the way that it does is because of a series of decisions that have designed our society to exist and sort of manifest itself in this way. And this country can't lie to you anymore once you're sort of equipped with that toolkit of information. And in the process of writing this book, like, that is largely what I was kind of doing for myself. It was 4 years of trying to accumulate knowledge and information and a toolkit with which to more effectively understand this period of American history that I understood on a sort of surface level, but didn't actually understand in any way that was commensurate with the impact that it had on this country.
Yeah, isn't that kind of the irony of the sort of moral panic about critical race theory? It's like, you know, history shouldn't be a political tool. It's not propaganda. And it's like, what do you think you've been taught? What do you think has been taught for the last 150 years? It has been systematically used as a political tool to not not even effectively, right? It was like the education system was hijacked to cover up the crimes and to rationalize a thing for a bunch of people that were already dead. That's what's so baffling to me about it. When you talk, like, cause I'll get emails from people when I talk about this stuff, people will feel so intensely about it. And it's look, I have studied history deeply. I've been to the same places that you've been in the book. I've written about the Civil War. I'm fascinated with all this stuff. It doesn't make me not like America. It just makes me see America as it actually was. And actually, I think the greatest civil rights leaders, I mean, what was so brilliant about Martin Luther King, for instance, was his ability to get, and Frederick Douglass as well, is get to the core of what actually America was about and to use those documents and that idea and those ideals to show how morally hypocritical we are being and try to urge people towards those ideas, right? So I just don't get this idea that, you know, looking at the terrible things that happened in the past somehow diminish our prospects for a brighter future. On the exact contrary, you understand what happened so you can grow and learn from it and be made better. And then also ideally make restitution or adjustments to compensate for the lingering consequences of those injustices.
Absolutely. And I think that part of the reason we can't even have a real conversation about restitution and about reparations is because we're not all operating with the same sort of epistemological set of information, right?
Like, we don't occupy the same reality.
We don't. We occupy two fundamentally different, if we're to sort of generalize, like two different spheres of truth and knowledge. Mm-hmm. And obviously that has been exacerbated by the nature of our current media ecosystem, which I think, you know, amplifies the sort of worst impulses of so many people. But it's one of those things where it is not as if there are not examples of what a more proactive and honest reckoning could look like, right? I mean, Germany does this, you know, and one of the places that I go in the book to draw that comparison, I think about Angola prison. Mm-hmm. And so Angola is one of the places I go, and it is the largest maximum security prison in the country, 18,000 acres wide, bigger than the island of Manhattan. It is a place where 75% of the people held there are black men, over 70% of them are serving life sentences. And it is built on top of a former plantation.
It's basically an American gulag.
What I tell people is that if you were to go to Germany and you had the largest maximum security prison in Germany built on top of a former concentration camp in which the people held there were disproportionately Jewish, that place would rightfully and so clearly be a global emblem of anti-Semitism.
You'd be like, something doesn't smell right. That just doesn't make sense.
It would be absurd. It would be abhorrent. We would never allow a place like that to exist because it would run counter to all of our moral and ethical sensibilities. It's disgusting to even think about it. And yet, here in the United States, We have the largest prison in the country where the vast majority of people are black men serving life sentences, many of whom were sentenced as children, many of whom were sentenced by non-unanimous juries, which has since been rendered unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of the United States because it existed with the specific intention to continue to convict as many black people as possible, who are working in these fields of what was once a plantation for virtually no pay while someone watches over them on horseback with a gun over their shoulder. And so part of what I'm exploring are what are the ways that a history of white supremacy not only enacts physical violence against people's bodies, but also collectively numbs us to certain types of structural and systemic violences that in another global context would so clearly be unacceptable. And the thing that the reason that that kind of thing doesn't happen in Germany is because that country, not perfectly, but proactively, is engaged in a process of saying this, we did this thing, the Holocaust. And it was done in our name, and it is one of the most shameful, horrific things that have ever been done in human history. And it was not that long ago. There are people who are still alive today who lived through what we did, who lost people they loved because of what we did, millions and millions of people. And so there are monuments, there are museums, there are... one of my favorite things is they have these things called stumbling stones, which are these sort of tens of thousands of these brass bricks almost that are sort of slightly elevated off the ground. And, you know, you can't go into a Nike store or a restaurant or a yoga studio without encountering one of these bricks that has the name of the person who used to live in that residence, whether it's still a residence or whether it's become a commercial property.
It forces you to bump into the injustices of history.
All over, right? You see the name, you see the date they were taken, you see what happened to them. And so you are regularly encountering in as part of the everyday landscape, these reminders of what was done. And so that infiltrates itself, into the sensibilities and the public consciousness of people in that country that then informs how they make decisions about how to make amends for what has happened historically and also how to move forward and create political decisions and public policy decisions in a domestic and global context that are set on not making that same mistake again, or not falling into the same level of malevolence that was once central and defining to that nation.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts for having multiple vehicles on on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. And what I would add to that, and I think that's what you just said is beautifully expressed, and the analogy with Angola and a concentration camp, I hadn't quite thought of. It's very, very compelling. What I would add is this isn't just about moral penance or like, you know, washing away blood guilt, although I actually think that is important and should be done, because a culture sort of weighed down by these things is flawed. But there's a self-interest to it too. I mean, first off, you could argue part of the reason Germany goes down that path is because the United States at the point of a gun sort of forces what they called denazification that unfortunately we didn't quite do in the South after the Civil War. But I just read this fascinating book by Jack Weatherford called Indian Givers. It's not a great title. It was actually written in the 80s, but it's a look at all of the sort of things that we got from the Native Americans, who we also, you know, if you want to talk about a Holocaust, we perpetuated a Holocaust here in America against the Aboriginal people. And what he was talking about in the book is all these things. And it really hit me because I'm from California. I now live in the South, but you know, race is Native Americans. It's more of a part of the sort of cultural conversation and history in California than race is because it wasn't a slave state. And you know, not really part of the Civil War, but you know, I've had a bit of a blind spot as to the severity and the horrific tragedy of what we perpetuate against Native Americans. And reading this book, it was very eye-opening and inspiring and interesting. And anyways, the one of the things he concludes the book with, and I encourage everyone to read it, is he's talking about it's not just all the things we got from Native Americans that we should be grateful for. But he says the cautionary tale is what our racism and our fear and our sort of insatiability took from us. You know, he talks about all these things that, you know, Native Americans discovered that they brought to us, all these modern medicines at the root of this and that, ways of hunting, ecological preservation. And he's like, as the last of these people die out, they are taking with them knowledge and understanding and a way of living that is lost to us forever. And that's been happening, he said, for 500 years. I think that's the other tragedy of this sort of distorted, dishonest history we've told ourselves, is that it hasn't served anyone well. It didn't serve, obviously, Black people well. But, you know, the perpetuation of this screwed up system and this hatred, it hasn't served America well either, you know? Mm. And I think that's the big thing. You should look at history and you should learn from it, not just so you don't do bad things, but also it is through the mixing of cultures and perspectives that you unlock incredible power and collaboration and creativity.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's absolutely true. And I think all of us have to just move through the world with a level of humility, and recognize that there's a lot we don't know, and that like the project of our lives in so many ways is to both learn and to unlearn so much of what we've been taught. Part of what I loved and tried to model the book after was the sort of generosity and graciousness of so many of the public historians and tour guides, yes, and docents who I met, who are balancing this sense of generosity while also holding a sense of responsibility and accountability, which is to say, you know, I think about the two women that I met at Monticello when I went to Monticello Plantation, which is, as many know, the home of Thomas Jefferson, one of our founding fathers and the third president of the United States. And I was on this tour, which is focused specifically on the history of slavery at Monticello. And these two women, Donna and Grace, were on the tour. And I was kind of watching them as we were on this tour by this guy named David Thorson, who in the course of 45 minutes to an hour had really given a masterclass on the sort of contradictions and hypocrisy and cognitive dissonance of Thomas Jefferson, and also centering the story of Monticello not only on Jefferson, but on the hundreds of enslaved people who lived there. Because the thing about Jefferson is that, you know, he wrote one of the most important documents in the history of the Western world. He also enslaved over 600 people over the course of his lifetime, including four of his own children. He, you know, wrote in one document that all men are created equal, and wrote in another document that Black people are inferior to whites in both endowments and body, in endowments of body and mind, as he put it. And so how, you know, when I went to Monticello, part of what I'm trying to get a sense of is like, how do you as an institution tell an honest and fuller, more robust, an intellectually rigorous story about who Jefferson was and what he stood for. And so that's what David is doing. And Donna and Grace are sitting there and their mouths are kind of agape and they're clearly unsettled. And I go up to them after and I was like, you know, I'd love to hear about how you experienced, you know, what you just heard. And Donna was like, man, he really took the shine off the guy. And they're like, I had no idea Jefferson owned slaves. I had no idea Monticello was a plantation. These are people who bought plane tickets, who rented cars, who were
have good jobs,
were self-proclaimed history buffs, right? And they came to this site as a sort of pilgrimage to see the home of the founding father, you know, of one of our first presidents, and had no idea that it was the home of somebody who enslaved hundreds of human beings. And that moment was such an important reminder to me that there are so many people across this country, just millions of people, who don't understand the history of slavery in any way that is commensurate and proportionate to the impact that it had and continues to have on this country. But the thing that people like David do is that they are holding, as I said, this sort of like, I recognize that millions of us across generations have been failed by our educations and have not been presented with information that helps us more fully understand this part of American history.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, but at the same time, you have a responsibility now that you are encountering this information to hold it and to sit uncomfortably with it and to consider what it means, how, and to put it in conversation with the story of America and of our founding fathers that you've been taught in order to recalibrate and reconceptualize how you understand what you understand the history of this country to be. And part of what I wanted the book to do was hold that same level of both generosity and accountability, which is to say we can't run from this information, especially when it's right in front of us. But I also recognize that in the same way that I didn't know a lot of this stuff at the beginning, many of my readers might not have known a lot of this stuff. And that's okay as long as we are using this as an opportunity to say, I didn't know, but now I do, and I also want to know more.
Like, have you been to the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam?
I've not.
It's like one of the most moving, sobering things you'll ever do in your life. Like you see where this like family of eight people, these two families, eight people live in this, you know, tiny attic. Mm. And it brings home the reality of the Holocaust in a way that you can't, you know, comprehend in any other way. And I think that's the other thing is like when you have this whitewashed, you know, dishonest view of history. Yeah, sure, it might make your plantation tour, you know, slightly less uncomfortable, and you can have your plantation wedding at one of these venues or something and not feel bad about it. But it also deprives you and us of other transcendence, the wrong word, but deeply moving and, you know, transformative experiences. I was just reading that, the National Park Service is taking over the Forks of the Road site in Natchez, Mississippi, and they're building a national park sort of monument to one of the most prolific slave markets in the United States. Mm. And I think that when you wrestle with history and you're not afraid of indicting people, again, who are long since dead, what it gets you is opportunities for things like that. It's, you know, and it's funny, as controversial as it is right now, you can imagine 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 50 years from now, that place will have been visited by millions and millions of tourists, right? Who came and learned and experienced something. So it's so funny that we're resistant to questioning and showing things in the slightest unfavorable light. But it's really ourselves and future generations who we are depriving by doing it. We're not protecting anyone. We're actually depriving them. Like, yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. No. It's a huge disservice. And part of what I hope that we are moving toward is a sense that, like, for so long in the history of this country, we have deprived people from understanding the totality of this history, in ways that have incredibly detrimental impacts on all of our lives, you know. Part of what has happened is that we have allowed these artificially created notions that are created with the specific intention of demarcating who has power and who doesn't, to give us a distorted sense of who deserves certain things and who doesn't deserve other things, or why certain communities look one way and why certain communities look another way. But, you know, I think this is related. I think all the time about, and this I think really became clear for me in the book, you were talking about, like, what happens with across generations with this. And I think about people who, clearly I think about the enslaved all the time. And what I think about, and especially now that Juneteenth is a federal holiday, I've been thinking about this a lot, but the idea that, you know, if we're to think about the first enslaved people coming to the United States in 1619, or what would become the United States, the British colonies that would become the U.S. in 1619 in Virginia, you know, Black people were fighting for freedom in this country from the moment they arrived on these shores, which means that the vast majority of people who fought for freedom never got a chance to see it. Mm-hmm. But that also doesn't mean that what they fought for was for nothing, right? Because what they did was create the space for the next generation to continue fighting, and then for the next generation, and for the next generation, and ultimately a moment opened up in history that led to the emancipation of Black people in this country and the abolition of one of the worst things and one of the worst institutions that this country has ever had. And that is only possible because of the millions and millions of people who fought their entire lives for something that they never got a chance to see themselves. And for me, that is what all of us are called to do, right? That, like, my life is only possible because of generations of people who fought for something that they knew they might never see, but fought for it anyway. And so what responsibility does that give me mm-hmm. to try to fight for and build for, or build toward and write toward and create toward a better world that I might never see, that my children might never see, but that someday someone will, you know? Like, I think that that's a responsibility that we all carry.
Yes, Seneca has a great line. He says, we can't choose our parents, but we can choose whose children we would like to be. Hmm. And to me, that's the choice that we have when we study history, right? Is who, it doesn't matter where you're born, what race you are, you know, you could have had a long generation, a long family tree, you all fought for the Confederacy, but you can choose to be related to Frederick Douglass. Like, you can choose to be the heir to Frederick Douglass, or an abolitionist, or, you know, a freedom fighter of any kind. Like, we get to choose. We're not chained to the past. In this, the past happened, but we choose whether we're going, like, we choose whether we are going to chain ourselves to it. And that's what I meant about this sort of analogy with my grandparents. Like, am I going to choose to be the descendant of my great-grandfather who fought for the Germans, or am I going to choose to be the grandson of my grandfather who landed at Normandy, right? Am I going to choose? And then on that side of the family, he's from Michigan, you know, moves to California, never experiences, you know, it sort of has more of the American dream. My grandmother graduated from Little Rock High School before it was desegregated. Whose tradition am I going to follow in, right? What torch am I going to carry? And it's just so strange that we willingly choose to carry the bad torch. But a lot of people choose that. It's quite surreal. Or we choose, you know what? We choose not to think about it at all. Did you read Wright Thompson's piece in The Atlantic about Emmett Till?
I did, yeah.
Oh my God. First off, beautiful piece. Everyone should read it. I took two things from it. One, that Carol Bryant is still alive.
Yeah.
That the woman who accused Emmett Till is still walking the earth. So we think about history, you know, Faulkner talks about the past not being the past. I mean, she's literally not dead yet. But the thing that struck me that I think is representative is a cautionary tale of that story is the family that owns the house and the barn where Emmett Till was murdered. The guy's like, oh yeah, I just choose not to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Wasn't that very striking that he could sit in his pool and not really think about what happened?
I mean, it was so revealing. I mean, and it's in some ways clarifying. I mean, in the sense that, like, you know, you mentioned plantation weddings, and there was a huge part of my book, or a significant part of my book, that was initially about plantation weddings, and we ended up cutting it because, you know, I didn't want the book to be overly sprawling and too massive, and I wanted it to be as tight as possible. But what was interesting is that I went to a bunch of plantations where people hold weddings, and I just wanted to understand, like, what would motivate someone to want to celebrate one of the most joyous days of their life on the site of what I can only understand as being a place of intergenerational torture and exploitation.
A mini, like, Holocaust.
You know, exactly. Like, what leads to that? Is it that they know and don't care? Is it that they don't know? Or is it that they know and that is, they actually kind of relish in that, you know? And that is the sort of question, and I think it depends for each person. But I think it's tied to this idea of that dentist, you know, sitting in his pool and looking over at his barn and saying, that is a place that was in which this horrific thing happened, that was one of the most, you know, arguably one of the most important events in 20th century American history. Certainly in the sense that the murder and lynching of Emmett Till is part of what precipitated the civil rights movement. And to look at it and be like, it feels so distant for him. And I think that distance is a microcosm of the distance that so many people in this country feel about these parts of history that they feel have nothing, they believe and have convinced themselves that it doesn't have anything to do with them, when it actually has everything to do with them. It has everything to do with all of us. And the problem is that whether it be slavery or indigenous genocide or contemporary immigration issues or Japanese American internment, I mean, all of these things that we are, should be deeply shameful of as a country, many of us have convinced ourselves that it is somehow over there and that it has nothing to do with us. But it does, because we are here and we are part of the story that will or won't be told about these things, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, and he didn't come off as a bad person. He didn't come off as a racist or a weirdo who's sort of creepily into this stuff. It was just kind of a benign, deliberate ignorance of the implications of a thing that was literally in his backyard. It was almost, I mean, Wright is such an amazing writer. I this is why it hit us over the head, I think, but it was so symbolic that it really does wake you up a bit.
Yeah, and I just learned a lot of, I think there was a lot of reporting in that piece that I just hadn't been familiar with. You know, I don't think I I don't actually think I knew that it had happened, that so much of what happened before he was thrown into the river had happened in a barn at all.
I'd never heard of the barn.
Yeah. And it's just, again, it was a reminder for me that, like, even the stories we think we know, there's a lot of that we don't, a lot that we don't know. And, you know, the thing about writing a book like this is the research was the research was the reason I wrote it. It was to give to provide me with information in history that was deeply important and transformative for me personally. But, you know, every new book you open provides a new level of nuance, provides a new detail, provides a new way of thinking about something that I, you know, had spent years thinking about. And that is why, you know, the scholars and historians who do this work, who dedicate their lives to this work, whether they're academic historians or public historians, are so important, because they're always, I think about somebody like Annette Gordon Reed, whose work on Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings.
That's why they were talking about her at Monticello. Like,
changed the whole conversation in this country around how we understood Thomas Jefferson. I mean, like, an exemplar of what, like, deep, rigorous historical work can do. They, you know, I talked to people who went to Monticello 10, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and they're like, the Monticello you went to sounds very different than the one that I went to. Because they were not talking about any of this before, and to me that provides me with hope, because people can change, yes. Institutions can change. We can gain new information and tell different stories, tell more honest stories. And I think Monticello is a place that is always attempting to interrogate what they do or don't do, what stories they tell and don't tell, and as a result, have evolved in the way that they have told the story of Jefferson in a way that I think is really important. For so many of us.
And look, that change is in your self-interest, right? And another deeply reported book that I was just thinking about is the Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about the Tuskegee experiments. Our failure to talk about those things, atone for them, address them, and learn from them, you want to talk about why certain communities are slightly more vaccine hesitant, which, you know, again, has implications for everyone. It's because we're too afraid to go deal with things. And the failure to deal with those unpleasant historical events and injustices has ongoing consequences for the future that negatively affect you and your children. Like, lying about the past is not a victimless crime, is, I guess, what I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely true. And we feel, the future generations feel the effects of that.
Yes.
And it shapes, again, like, what are, you know, I think about the origin point of this book. And this book was written began being written in 2017, when I was watching several Confederate statues come down in my hometown, statues of P.G.T. Beauregard, Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, all these statues coming down in New Orleans, after sort of 2 years of litigation and political fights and battles.
I watched the Robert E. Lee statue come down in New Orleans. I was there. It was a pretty moving experience.
Yeah, no, it's, I wish I'd been able to be there. I watched the live stream from my home here in Maryland. And what I was thinking about was, like, what does it mean that I grew up in a city in which there are more homages to enslavers than there are to enslaved people?
A guy who never even went to New Orleans.
Had nothing to do with New Orleans, right? Like, I mean, but again, is a reminder that Robert E. Lee was just an avatar.
Yes.
For this sort of larger message that folks at that time were trying to send. And, you know, I thought about what it meant that to get to school, I had to go down Robert E. Lee Boulevard. To get to the grocery store, I had to go down Jefferson Davis Highway. That my middle school was named after a leader of the Confederacy. That my parents still live on a street named after somebody who owned 150 enslaved people.
Yeah, not Louis Armstrong, not Little Wayne Boulevard, or, you know, any actual heroes of that city.
And what are the implications of that? Because symbols and iconography and Street names, they're not just symbols. They are reflective of the stories that people tell. And those stories shape the narratives that communities carry. And those narratives shape public policy. And public policy shapes the material conditions of people's lives, as we've talked about. And, you know, that's not to say that taking down a 60-foot tall statue of Robert E. Lee is going to erase the racial wealth gap. But it is to say that these are all part of an ecosystem of ideas and stories that are told that shape how we understand what has happened in American history, what has happened in this country, what has happened in our respective cities and communities, and thus what needs to be done in order to make amends for the harm that has transpired over the course of this history, to build a more just and equitable and fair world. And, you know, so when we talk about this, you know, the deception and lies that are, you know, that we've been taught or that our kids are taught, or that all of these things are a part of it. And like, we can, you know, I think about Jeff, who we talked about earlier in our conversation. Like, Jeff could tell a different story. Jeff, instead of telling his own granddaughters the story that his grandfather told him, he could hold his granddaughter's hands, walk through that cemetery and say, these are your ancestors. These are members of your family, and they fought a war to preserve a terrible, terrible thing. But you are not defined by the decisions that your family has made. You can make a different set of decisions, and you are not tethered to that history, because that history does not singularly define you. And that there are people who make that decision. We just need more people to make that decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's another sad thing that I've realized sort of as I studied American history and the Civil War, is that where the Lost Cause mythology really deprived us of a inspiring historical narrative came with Reconstruction. The passage of the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, the Freedmen's Bureaus, the immense work that we tried to do as a country to begin to address some of the wrongs of slavery before, you know, that cause was betrayed and undermined for, you know, political purposes, before we abandon it. We almost did the right thing. You know what I mean? And there's no monuments to that. Instead, we celebrate Robert E. Lee and Nathan Bedford Forrest. We don't study, you know, the people who We don't celebrate Thaddeus Stevens, right? Mm-hmm. Or the people who went down south and taught in those schools. We don't celebrate Booker T. Washington, or, you know, we don't celebrate the people who, out of the wreckage of that historical injustice, tried to push us in the right direction. And to me, that's a real tragedy. And it's a lost opportunity, because then we don't get to pick up where they left off, and it, you know, it stalled us out for like 100 years.
Yeah, it absolutely did. And there's a lot of work to be done to sort of like unwedge us from these, a lot of the BS that's been propagated over the course of centuries. And what I wanted to do with this book was equip myself with more information, more tools, a better framework, to make sense of what has happened, and to be able to look at this country with clearer eyes, and to be able to look at it with a level of clarity that I don't think I'd had before, and I hope that it can do that for the reader as well.
It absolutely did. It's a wonderful book. I to end on a positive note, I saw the picture that you posted on Instagram when you were FaceTiming with your grandparents.
Yeah.
With the news that the book had hit number one, which is an incredibly difficult accomplishment.
You know, I'm just trying to be like you.
But so tell me how that went, and tell me what they think of it, because a lot of the history that you're talking about in the book, obviously not the Civil War itself, but some of the more recent stuff, like they were alive for. When were they born?
My grandfather was born in 1930, Jim Crow, Mississippi. My grandmother was born in 1939, Jim Crow, Florida. And it was so special to be able to share that with them. I mean, it was special in many ways, because they are featured in the book. The epilogue is largely about the two of them and a trip that we took to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And, you know, one of the things that my grandmother was saying when we talked about our visit to that museum a few years ago, she was just looking around and we were realizing how much of the history in that museum and how much of the violence documented in that museum is something that they experienced firsthand. And my grandmother kept saying, she was like, I lived it.
Yeah, that was news, not history to her.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also gave me a sense of, a more acute sense of our proximity to that history and that period of time. You know, I feel like I was taught about slavery as if it was this thing, you know, especially when I was in like elementary and middle school, that it was this thing that happened in like the Jurassic period, you know, that it was like dinosaurs and the Flintstones and slavery, almost as if they all happened at the same time.
Even though the school you were in New Orleans was probably built in the Civil War.
Yeah, no, for it's sure. Absurd. I mean, as the historian Walter Johnson says, the whole city of New Orleans is a memorial to slavery. And, you know, I think about the National Museum of African American History and Culture and think about how the woman who opened that museum alongside the Obama family in 2016 was the daughter of an enslaved person, right? Not the granddaughter or the great-granddaughter. Right. She was the daughter of someone born into intergenerational chattel slavery. And this is someone who was alive in 2016, just recently passed away. I was doing an NPR interview and one of the people who called in at his local station was talking about how she was raised by this little woman, I believe in her 70s, talking about how she was raised by her great grandfather. And she called him Pappy. And her great grandfather was someone who was born into slavery. Right. Wow. So like there are people who are alive today who loved, who were in community with, who were raised by people born into chattel slavery in this country. And so when I speak to my grandparents, and that's part of what that last section of the book is about, I'm reminded that this history we tell ourselves was a long time ago wasn't that long ago at all. My grandfather's grandfather was enslaved. So when my four-year-old son sits on my grandfather's lap, I think about my grandfather sitting on his grandfather's lap. And it is just a really intimate reminder that in the scope of human history, you know, this thing was just yesterday. And any suggestion someone would have that it has nothing to do with what the contemporary landscape of inequality looks like in this country, or what our social, economic, and political infrastructure look like and how they operate, they're being morally and intellectually disingenuous.
Or worse. Clint, thank you so much. I love the book. I'm so glad we got to talk. I can't wait for whatever journey the next book takes you on.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me.
There is only one more day to sign up for the Daily Stoic Leadership Challenge. I'm so excited. We've got a huge group of people who are lined up and ready to take this challenge with us. We're going to be talking to GMs of one of the great sports dynasties in American history. We're going to be talking to some military leaders, business leaders, entrepreneurs, people who have made it their business to study these questions of leadership. Each day you get an email from me. It's 63 emails, more than 30,000 words of all new content that helps you take the right steps along that week's path. There's gonna be 3 leadership Q&As with me. Again, a live office hours video session with me. Ancient Wisdom for the Modern Leader. That's gonna be a masterclass in leadership with the cadence and rigor of a bootcamp. It's also a live course, which means all the participants will join the course together. We're gonna move through it together. The same goal. I'm so excited about the material we've put together for you. There is seriously just one more day at midnight Central Time. The challenge closes. You can't sign up after that. And then we're all going to be in this awesome cohort for the next 9 weeks. I hope to see you there. Sign up now. Talk soon. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.